Is it the recession you have when you're not having a recession? With an election looming, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg is just weeks away from delivering his first and possibly last federal budget. Last week, the OECD warned the Australian economy had fallen into a per capita recession.
Another bleak outlook for the world economy.
Today's national accounts show Australia's economy slowed sharply at the end of last year.
For the first time since 2006, with global and Australian growth predicted to slow even further. The announcement prompted scepticism. Ross Gittins called it a scare tactic, saying that any recession qualified by an adjective is not the real deal. With wage growth flatlining and house prices tumbling, economists predict that interest rates could fall as low as 1%.
The Australian economy is in fundamentally good shape.
The next election will be a referendum on wages.
As we head into the election, both parties grapple with what the central issue will be. This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire, and this week, has the recession we all feared finally arrived? Or is the economy being used as a tool once again to instill panic and fear? Welcome back to Please Explain. Would-be marathon runner Jessica Irvine and multiple marathon runner Shane Wright.
Yes, this is a new development. I signed up yesterday, so I shall be running my first marathon in September.
And Shane, can you tell us how many marathons you've run?
I have run 19 of the buggers. And for Jess's sake, the worst one is the first one, because you may notice this, Jess will be shorter when she completes it. Your body compresses after a marathon.
Compact. You tell me this now. You could have told me this the day before yesterday.
Well, I haven't told you about the bone pain that you're going to suffer after the first marathon, but that'll come later. Let me tell you about that later.
Well, it's all very inspiring, but not enough to inspire me to give it a go myself. I'll stick to the halves.
Oh, come on. You'll get there. Two halves is a full. There you
right.
go. That's so economics. That's how it works.
Thanks for joining me again, both of you. I want to talk to you about quite a few things today, but I want to start with per capita recession. Shane, what is a per capita recession and are we in one?
A per capita recession is effectively taking into account that a growing population grows an economy by itself. You take out or you exclude what's going on in population and you see what's going on with the economy. And for the first time since 2006, the last 6 months, GDP per person has fallen. Now, there are some who say, polywaffle, this is just made up stuff. The ABS actually does monitor GDP per capita. It's a widely used metric of how an economy is going. It's just that it doesn't happen very often. And in Australia's case, it just has.
And what does it actually mean for people? What does it mean to me that my per capita GDP has fallen?
The volume of stuff that we make and produce and service, there's actually a little bit less of it to go around for each one of us. So we're just a little bit poorer in that regard, as opposed to if you look at the GDP figures, they show we're growing because we're producing more stuff. Once you measure it out amongst the punters, yeah, not so much.
And is it an indicator of what's coming? Is there a trend that if you're in per capita recession, you're headed for the scary R word?
I think there are other better indicators showing what's going on with the economy. The GDP ones are, in general, are the, say, job ads are another. The capital plans from business is another. What's going on in retail, which is a disaster at the moment. They're better indicators of what's coming to womp us over the next few months.
Jess, Ross Gittins said that per capita recession is not a real thing because any recession that has to be qualified by an adjective is not real. What do you think about it as a measure?
Well, we tend to say a recession is two consecutive quarters of contraction in the output of real GDP output. So we haven't got that yet. It's still growing 0.3, 0.2 in the last two quarters. So we are growing. I think the interesting wrinkle on this, which might help to explain it for people, is the difference between volumes and price. So GDP is a measure of the volume, you know, how many widgets, what do you look at it? Is it bigger or smaller that we're producing? And there's also price measures in the national accounts. So that's how much are we getting paid for the value of that output. And the interesting thing at the moment is that the volume of stuff we're producing isn't growing as fast, but the prices we're receiving when we do produce it are actually quite strong. And most of that story is about our commodity prices are remaining high. It's because although we've seen sort of growth come off in China, they're actually due to some environmental restrictions. Until they actually started stopping our coal at the ports, which happened recently, they were actually there was high demand for our high-grade coal and iron ore because they were switching away from dirty domestic sources. So it actually means that commodity prices are up. So the price story is good. And, you know, what matters to you is not the value or the output of work you do, but how much you get paid for it. So we're actually in a situation where the budget's going to be doing okay because the prices are up, which is a different situation to what we had when the last time we did, I would say, have a close escape with a recession, which was during after the GFC. We saw that our national income did come down. It shrank, but we didn't call that a recession. Shane can probably pick me up on this. I think we did have two consecutive quarters of contraction in real national net disposable income. So there was a bit of an income recession, but we didn't call it a recession because we didn't get the volume, the GDP contraction that we sort of use as the rule of thumb. So back then we had weak prices, activity hadn't come off. We were sort of now in a mirror reverse, and it's sort of, you know, put your finger out the window, does it feel like a recession? And many people would say no, because the budget is still steaming back to surplus. The unemployment rate is incredibly low at 5%. So, you know, gosh, there you go, statistics and lies. What is it? You know, it's a pick a measure. And of course, this is all happening on the eve of an election. So Labor's picked the negative number and pulled it out and whacked the government with it. And then the government is going to whack back and say that Labor will turn us into a recession. So that's why we're obsessing about it.
I was going to say, Tori, this gets you to the point of the link that many people make between budget management and economic management, and they are distinctly different things, because Josh Frydenberg has got a bit of a windfall coming in terms of, say, the better iron ore prices, the better coal prices, even the better wheat prices. I noticed wheat prices jumped another 5% overnight because of concern about drought in Texas, of all places. That feeds into better income that he'll splurge a bit on. If you look at what, say, the ANZ today, their economics team have abandoned their call that there would be rate rises this year and next. They've said, no, there's nothing going to happen because the economy is softening and has softened. So you've got these two different things going on. Budget management, which every government tries to say is all because of them and how great they are at managing the economy, whereas the economy is quite separate and does its own thing on quite often. As we go back to, say, 2008, you mentioned, say, what went on in the mining sector. The mining sector, the iron ore miners laid off 20% of their workers in a six-month period. But the budget, all that income that was coming in at the time helped the budget, and it helped soften some of the blows that came about.
So we're less than 3 weeks until Josh Frydenberg's first and possibly last attempt to hand down a budget. He's definitely going to be able to deliver on their promise of a surplus, isn't he?
Well, he'll promise one. Whether he'll be around to deliver it is a completely different story, and
right,
we won't know whether it's a surplus until September next year. Remember, Wayne Swan promised surpluses as well and never got there.
I mean, that seems to be the big sort of talisman in budgets for governments to talk about the surplus. But what's the really important parts of it in your view? What are the bits that are going to affect the way people feel when they, you know, are weighing up whether they feel like we're living in recession?
I think it'll be around the tax cuts that they're going to produce, because we know that they'll use that the revenue that there's going to come in, that they're going to increase the tax cuts that are supposed to that kick in from July 1. We know there's $9 billion worth of spending that was put away in the mid-year budget update, which they're going to announce somewhere between now and maybe during the election campaign. That will be money to either or pensioners and families. We know that that is coming. That's what they're going to try and sell as, we can promise a surplus while giving you all this money to make you feel better.
So let's talk about wages, because I think one of the reasons that perhaps people might feel like the economy is not going along as strongly as some of the figures show is because people's wages are not rising. Jess, Labor are talking about some kind of mechanism that they haven't really spelled out yet on legislating to increase the minimum wage.
They've promised that we will have a minimum wage which is consistent with a decent living wage. Mm. Fair Work Commission that determines the minimum wage already takes that into account. They sit down and they moderate between the unions who say, we want a living wage, we want, you know, prices, you know, wages to go up 10%. Then employers come back and say, no, we can't afford it. We'll have to sack everyone or we won't able to employ people. We want it to be 2%, and they usually land somewhere in the middle. So I can't actually see that Labor is proposing anything very specific that will alter that process. There might just be there's a lot of sound and fury that they want, you know, something which is closer to what the unions would define as a living wage. So maybe, but then they can't interfere with the independent umpire. So it is a bit of sort of, well, vote for us, we'll increase your wage, but is very unclear how that would actually change under a Labor government.
Is a living wage a subjective thing or an object? Like, is there actually a definition of what the living wage should be? Or is it, do the unions have their version of what is a living wage and the government has their version of what it is?
You could go back to the Harvester decision of 1906, which was the living wage at that time was determined as what a man with three children and a wife had to survive on. It is, you're right, it's very subjective. I'm sure Jess's cost of living is substantially higher than mine because she lives in Sydney. So, for instance, that's something that you have to take into account. Remember that the Fair Work Commission, its last decision, which was over 3%, they remarked at the time that one of the reasonings was because of what's going on around penalty rates, because they recognised when that penalty rate decision was made, and this is the one that the Labor has promised to repeal, would have a detrimental impact to people who relied on that. So the Fair Work Commission's also got itself into a bit of trouble trying to offset the impact of its decisions around certain groups in the community.
So what about people on wages that are higher than the minimum wage? The people in the middle whose wage growth has been very flat. What can be done for those people? I mean, our unemployment rate, it is at almost record lows at 5%, but it's still a lot higher than it is in the US, where they've got wage growth because their unemployment rate is now so low. At what point, what are the economic indicators that will show us that perhaps wage growth might start?
Yeah, well, this is something, it's like waiting for Godot. We've been waiting for wages to pick up in response to the economy not doing so bad. I sort of tend to think and it's been commented that we are in this new world of lower growth, lower inflation. Things are just more calm, more tepid than they used to be. So I don't think anybody should be expecting their wages to start going back to sort of 4 or 5% growth that we had before the GFC, because we have entered this new world. And I think there's a lot of ramifications that fall out of that we haven't really come to think about, you know, and it's coming through to property that we just won't be able to sustain price increases in property like we had before because we've just got wages growth so low. I mean, hopefully you expect, and the Reserve Bank does say that we've reached a turning point with wages so that the pace of growth is not decelerating as it was before. It's picking up incredibly slowly. And international experience has shown that the jobless rate really needs to go a lot lower than where it is now before we start to see the turnaround in wages that they've seen in other countries. And then even when they've had it, it's been pretty tenuous and pretty short-lived, and people do talk about global growth now being slower ahead. So wages growth outlook in other countries is being shaved off as well. So it's not a very good story, is it?
No.
Sorry, folks.
Shane, can you see any green shoots on the wages front?
Oh, sorry. I'll just wipe away the tears because of what Jess has just told me. It's that global growth issue. And we're actually seeing it in the United States because one of the people talk about, yes, there's been a lift in wages in the US. So many states actually have increased their minimum wages over in the United States because there's been research that has suggested that higher minimum wages aren't the job killers that some have maintained for a very long period of time. But you get into the US, the Don with these huge budget deficits, because off the back of his tax cuts, he's driven up inflation, which means wages had to rise. Otherwise, people would be going backwards. And there is a whole discussion whether the US is going to go into recession maybe next year on the back of all that going on. In terms of domestically, we come back to that per capita recession argument. Our population growth continues to help the economy grow in general. And so there is this argument that if you're bringing in 190,000 people a year on top of natural growth and falling death rates, then you have actually are putting a bit of a floor around how far things can tumble. And that's actually a good thing and a positive thing for the Australian economy. Maybe not for wages in particular. You get down to that argument whether higher wages or having a job is better.
Which is why, you know, when Scott Morrison was the Treasurer, he was all for keeping immigration at the level that he was at. He has wavered somewhat since becoming Prime Minister, especially with the New South Wales Treasurer, Premier Gladys Berejiklian, calling for a drop in numbers. How is a politician supposed to weigh up and articulate that debate between growth and migration when cities like Melbourne and Sydney are bursting at the seams?
Well, you actually get to a budget issue, because if you reduce the immigration intake, it will have to be reconciled in the budget numbers and it will reduce growth, which then feeds all the way through, say, your forecast for wages, which I think once we get to April 2, everyone will be looking at what's the government thinking is going to happen in terms of wages. And for the last 6 years, the Federal Treasury and the Reserve Bank have had to downgrade their forecasts for wages. On April 2, that will be downgraded again because the RBA has already done it. The Treasury will follow suit. So you're going to come back straight to that argument. And how you're getting into a really interesting argument about whether you can say, right, we're going to reduce population growth in general. Yes, it's going to have some sort of impact, but we've moved migrants around. We'll build infrastructure. You can pull together a picture. Whether it's vote worthy is another story, though.
My sense is that heat has really gone out of the population debate over Christmas when we've seen the precipitous falls in property prices in Sydney and in Melbourne. I mean, in New South Wales, we were having that population debate, you know, as prices would still look like we were pretty toppy in the market. That has completely fallen out. And, you know, a really good way to accelerate a price deflation in property prices is to cut immigration. So I wouldn't be surprised if Morrison, although we're expecting him and the budget does outline plans for migration, whether he will sort of quietly back away and not make that the centrepiece of what the budget's going to be about. It'll be about the tax cuts and other things. And I think that would be sensible, given that, you know, we're in this GDP per capita recession. If you were to cut, you know, migration more, that would have an impact there. And I think it's better that the government shifts its language towards sort of a growth and tax cuts, and this will help the economy grow rather than we're going to shut the doors and slow down the growth. So I can't see that they'll be making much of that population debate in the budget.
Can we spend the last few minutes talking about property? Shane, you and your colleague Eric Bagshaw are currently eyeball deep in writing a big package for this weekend's Sydney Morning Herald and The Age about the property boom and analysing its end, the end of it. What can you try and sum up where we're at in the property cycle in a lot less than 2,500 words?
Down, prices are down. Prices will continue to head down and then they'll stop falling and then they'll turn around. Like, the history of Australian property is up and down, big swings. And we mentioned this started with Lachlan Macquarie back in the 1810s, and it continued on. The depression that this country faced in the 1890s started in a Melbourne property market collapse, where prices fell about 32, 36%, took 20 years to recover, and then they ran into the Great Depression. There are cycles in property markets. In fact, the interesting thing is actually where the Reserve Bank went this week with releasing some research that it's showed that interest rate cuts helped push up property prices. Now, the Reserve Bank executive has been trying to say, oh, that's not quite true. They've looked at other factors, but their own research is pointing to it. So that's why we've got to a point where markets now are pricing in rate cuts this year because of what's gone on in property.
So what would be the incentive for rate cuts if they push up property prices? Is it the RBA saying we've gone far enough, we've dropped far enough?
I think they'd argue that it's about what's going on with consumers. And we come back to those wages as well. People need a few extra dollars. There's an argument that if there are sizable tax cuts in the budget, that may be enough to hold back the Reserve Bank, because they'll think, right, fiscal policy's working, we don't need to go any lower. Remember, interest rates now are lower since Elvis left the army. 1960. Calm down, Jess. I can see that you're excited by that little fact.
You have the most amazing factoids, Shane. I appreciate them a lot.
Yeah. So does Phil Lowe want to go back to Jerry Lou Lewis? And I'm not convinced he is.
I think so. RBA and interest rates is the main sort of wild card for the property market. It is absolutely true that interest rate cuts inflate housing prices, because when the interest rate goes down, you can afford to borrow a lot more. And that's what we saw in the end of the sort of 1990s. And we had a property boom then, because interest rates, where they went from those eye-watering sort of double-digit rates to something more like sort of 7-8%. And guess what? You know, house prices went up. We've had another structural shift down in interest rates after the GFC. We've got rates at record lows. And guess what? House prices inflated as well. So it is a question for the Reserve Bank of, do you want to protect all the property homeowners by cutting interest rates again? If they do, if the RBA decides that that's their job, and that the implications of having too much of a deflation in the property boom, it just would have too much of an effect on the real economy and jobs and people's confidence, then that will be sort of stepping in to support property values again. So you can't see much growth from here absent interest rate cuts. But if the Reserve Bank does decide that that's its job to get involved, or if it sees too much of an impact on the real economy from the property price deflation and cuts again, then yes, we could. That will increase people's capacity to borrow again.
Is any of this enough enticement to get you into the property market, Jess? You've been writing about agonising.
I'm trying to not have that sense of fear of missing out, and now it's actually the fear of getting out that people are suffering. You know, prices have been tumbling since I started writing columns about why I want to buy property. I will get in there in the long term, but I don't want to borrow too much, and I don't want to, stretch myself. And I would like, this is a good time for first home buyers to be thinking, maybe I can get that 20% deposit so I avoid lenders' mortgage insurance. So I'm sitting quietly on the sidelines. I am watching with interest as properties that I was looking at 12 months ago are now sort of worth substantially less. Long term, I will have the dream. The dream shall be mine. I might get a bargain.
That's the thing. The longer you wait, the cheaper they might become. Guys, thanks so much for joining me. I will lure you back onto the show the morning after the federal budget in the first week of April.
Yes.
We can.
Oh, something to look forward to.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks to our guests this week, Shane Wright and Jessica Irvine. If you know someone who would enjoy this week's episode, make sure you share it with them. Or better yet, grab their phones and get them subscribed to get new episodes every week. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Support the work we do. You can find the link to sign up in our show notes, or just pop subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age into your search engine. If you want to get in touch, you can. Our email is in the show notes. This episode was produced and edited by David Escort. Technical assistance from David McMillan. Special thanks to Amelia Maguire. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori. Thanks for listening.